Chapter 4. Democracy Faces a Hungry Winter. It was bitter enough for Vladimir Putin to witness the collapse of the Soviet ideal in Europe, helpless to reverse the losses. He knew that a divided Germany could not endure, despite Erich Honecker's vow early in 1989 that the Berlin Wall would stand in 50 and even in 100 years. For Putin, what mattered more was what he saw as an unconditional Soviet surrender, followed by a humiliating, chaotic, and catastrophic retreat. "That's what hurt," he said. "They just dropped everything and went away." The men and women he had worked with for nearly 5 years were cast aside, abandoned by their Soviet patrons, left to the mercy of West Germany and their own vengeful citizens. The Putin's neighbors and friends found themselves abruptly out of work, ostracized because of their employment in the Stasi. Katya's preschool teacher, an officer of the Stasi, was barred from working with children. One of Lyudmila's friends cried for her lost ideals, for the collapse of everything that she had believed in her whole life, she recalled. For them, it was the collapse of everything, their lives, their careers. The intelligence officers felt particularly betrayed. Markus Wolf, head of East Germany's foreign intelligence until 1986, resented Gorbachev's indifference after 1989, though he briefly received refuge in Russia. There had been no great rush of comradely support from our Moscow friends during the past stressful months, he wrote. Like us, they had been completely unprepared for what happened. The supposedly eternal brotherhood to which we had raised our glasses down the years was now a ragged band. Horst Böhm, the Stasi chief in Dresden, committed suicide in his home on February 21, 1990, shortly before he was to testify before a commission on the future of the unraveling state, though rumors persisted that he was murdered to prevent him from appearing in a criminal trial of Dresden's despotic boss, Hans Modrow. The East Germans soon learned the truth of the KGB's Operation Luch, the decades-long effort to spy on them. Horst Jämlich, Böhm's aide, felt betrayed by Putin personally. "They cheated and lied to us," he said. The KGB in East Germany was in disarray, scrambling to destroy or remove its intelligence files while severing or covering up its networks of agents and laying the foundations for new ones. The last chief in Dresden, General Shirokov, ordered the removal and destruction of 12 truckloads of documents from the headquarters of the Soviet Armored Division. They burned so many that the furnace designed for the task broke. A battalion commander then dug a pit on the grounds, dumped the papers, and ordered the pile doused with gasoline. Lieutenant Colonel Putin, too, burned files. "All our communications, our lists of contacts, and our agents' networks." But he and his colleagues spirited the most important ones back to the KGB archives in Moscow. The real danger was the exposure of the KGB's secrets to the West and NATO, though there was little he or anyone else in the Dresden outpost could do to stop that now. By the beginning of the new decade, Lieutenant Colonel Putin and his cadre had been recalled home, but he had one final mission as a Soviet intelligence operative. He continued to recruit informants, hoping to establish a new network of agents that would serve as a rear guard in the democratizing East Germany. He turned to his old friends and contacts, including an inspector in Dresden's police department and a Stasi officer named Klaus Zuchold, whom he had first met 4 years earlier. Zuchold had taken him on one of his first tours of Saxony, even before Lyudmila arrived, and visited him frequently. Zuchold apparently had never worked for the KGB until after the events of 1989. In January 1990, in one of his final acts, Lieutenant Colonel Putin formally recruited him, sending his Stasi file to the center in Moscow for approval. He dictated Zuchold's letter of allegiance to the KGB, gave his daughter a book of Russian fairy tales, and toasted the occasion with Soviet brandy. It proved to be a short-lived success. A year later, after the reunification of Germany in October 1990, Zukold accepted an offer of amnesty and not only revealed his own recruitment, but exposed 15 other agents who had been in the KGB's Dresden network. The betrayal of agents and the seizure of the Stasi's enormous collection of files by the West German BND, and subsequently their public disclosure, which also exposed the extent of the KGB's activities, enraged Lieutenant Colonel Putin. He later told his old friend Sergei Roldugin that the Stasi should never have turned over its archives, never have betrayed those who had worked as informants. Roldugin rarely heard him talk about his work and rarely saw him so emotional. "He said it was equal to treason," Roldugin recalled. "He was very upset, extremely, but also ashamed and remorseful. He had been powerless to help his German comrades as their secret world imploded. I felt it," he told Roldugin, "like a fault of my own." In February 1990, packing boxes, each numbered and named, filled the Putin's modest apartment. The apartment felt like a storage room. The KGB's withdrawal, followed by that of the Soviet military, suddenly freed up housing in Dresden. Jörg Hoffmann, a young man whose wife had connections in the city administration, managed to acquire the lease to the apartment. He stopped by to see it while the Putins awaited the movers. The walls were covered in tinfoil wallpaper, the windows decorated by cutouts of Russian nesting dolls made by the girls. The Putins were polite and friendly. The lieutenant colonel betrayed no outward bitterness or other emotion. He simply told Hoffmann he was going home. On March 1st, the Hoffmanns moved in. In 4.5 years, the Putins had managed to save some of the hard currency he earned, and a neighbor gave them a washing machine. It was 20 years old, but it worked for another 5 years. It was all they had to show for his career as a foreign intelligence agent. Their belongings were packed in a shipping container and sent to Moscow. The couple, with their two young daughters, boarded a train, also to Moscow. On the journey back, a thief made off with Lyudmila's coat and what rubles and marks she carried. The Putins had from afar followed the upheaval of Gorbachev's era, the public excitement engendered by perestroika and glasnost, but whatever they expected, what they found when they returned disappointed them. After the comparative comforts of East Germany, life at home seemed a shock. There were the same terrible lines, the ration cards, the coupons, the empty shelves, Lyudmila recalled. She feared going to the store, unable to sniff out the bargains and to stand in all the lines. I would just dart into the nearest store, buy whatever was most necessary, and go home. It was horrible. They had missed the liberating intellectual and political spirit of the era, the release of banned films and previously censored novels like The Master and Margarita. Mikhail Bulgakov's masterpiece, Imagining Satan's Visit to Moscow, or Boris Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago. The new freedom to read, to debate, to think openly had been electrifying for so many, but they had returned to Russia at the moment when Gorbachev's liberalizing reforms were beginning to unravel. Lyudmila felt her husband had lost touch with his life's real purpose. His career as a KGB officer stood at a crossroads. He joined a mass repatriation of intelligence operatives from abroad, not only from Germany, but from all of Eastern Europe and other far-flung battlegrounds of the Cold War, like Afghanistan, Angola, Mongolia, Vietnam, Nicaragua, and Yemen. They were defeated, dejected, and effectively out of work, displaced refugees of a crumbling empire. The center in Moscow was the typical destination for officers returning from a posting abroad. Only nothing was typical anymore. For 3 months at the beginning of 1990, Putin was not even paid. The KGB initially offered him a position at the first chief directorate's headquarters in Yashinovo, the wooded, heavily guarded compound southwest of Moscow. His rank and appointment would normally have merited an apartment in Moscow, but none was available. With so many intelligence veterans in search of homes, he would have to wait, possibly for years. Lyudmila liked Moscow and wanted to move there, and he understood that whatever prospects he had for advancement existed in the capital, not in Leningrad. But his vague doubts about the Soviet Union's future had hardened. After 15 years, his career was unspectacular and no longer inspiring. In his last year in Dresden, he sensed the disorganization of the organs of power, the breakdown of discipline, the theft and lawlessness within his own ranks. He met his old station chief and mentor, Colonel Lazar Matveyev, who was then stationed at Yashinovo. "I don't know what to do," he told Matveyev in the graying colonel's apartment in Moscow. Matveyev, for all his affection for his former underling, did nothing to persuade him to stay in Moscow or even in the KGB. "Talk Lyuda out of it," he told him intimately, "and go to Leningrad." There, at least, he had an apartment where they could live, his parents. The elder Putins had moved into a larger place, this time on Srednyokhtinsky Prospect, not far from the academy where Vladimir had first trained after joining the KGB. So he accepted a job as the assistant to the rector for international affairs at his old university, a KGB position intended to keep an eye on students and visitors. At last, he would be undercover, though the true identity of officials in posts like that was, by intention, a poorly kept secret. It never hurt for people to know the KGB lurked everywhere. He now rejoined what Oleg Kalugin, the former deputy director of the KGB in Leningrad, described as this absurd, stupendous ziggurat, this terrifyingly centralized machine, this religion that sought to control all aspects of life in our vast country. The university's rector, Stanislav Merkuryev, was a theoretical physicist appointed early in Gorbachev's tenure. He spoke English, German, and French, and was determined to open the stifled system of higher education. By the time of his early death in 1993, he had earned plaudits for making the university one of the best in Europe. He surrounded himself with like-minded professionals and, as he surely would have known, one last minder from the KGB. For an aging KGB veteran, the university post might have been a sinecure, comfortable and undemanding. But for a lieutenant colonel, only 37 and with years of service ahead of him, it seemed a dead end. He had little prospect now of securing another assignment abroad. The KGB was downsizing, and his achievements hardly merited a post. His career in foreign intelligence thus came crashing to an end. Not even Matveyev could reach down a hand to pull him up. He told Sergei Roldugin that he planned to leave the KGB altogether, though Roldugin had his doubts. "There is no such thing as a former intelligence agent," he said. He empathized with his friend's anger and confusion, but he also understood his mentality. "You can stop working at this organization, but its worldview and way of thinking remain stuck in your head." Leningrad had changed little outwardly, but perestroika breathed new life into the city's politics. In March 1989, while the Putins were still in Dresden, cities across the Soviet Union held the first competitive elections in the country's history to choose representatives to a new quasi-parliament, the Congress of People's Deputies. Instead of rubber-stamping Communist Party leaders, as Soviet elections invariably did, voters in Leningrad rebelled and rejected the top five candidates, including the city's party leader, Yuri Soloviev. One of those elected instead was a tall, charismatic professor of law at Vladimir Putin's alma mater, Anatoly Sobchak. Born deep in Siberia and educated in Leningrad, Sobchak had already gained prominence as a critic of the Soviet system. He wrote widely, advocating market reforms and the rule of law. His doctoral dissertation had been rejected as politically incorrect. Sobchak's law school colleagues had unexpectedly nominated him to be one of four candidates from the university's district on Vasilevsky Island, which also included the sprawling Baltic shipyard and thousands of shipbuilders and stevedores. Despite the Communist Party's efforts to screen out opposition candidates, Sobchak managed to place second in a kind of political caucus held in the shipyard's Palace of Culture, after delivering a late-night speech that extemporaneously evoked Martin Luther King Jr. "I dreamed of a time when our state would become law-governed, a state that didn't permit the granting of rights and privileges to some people at the expense of others," he wrote later. Though he had no electoral experience, Sobchak threw himself into politics. Like Gorbachev, he believed that the Soviet system could change with reforms, but he found himself and the country unprepared for the novelty of democracy after the decades of fear and suspicion that had fractured Soviet society. The peculiarities of the system, government-assigned employment, housing, and even vacations, meant that most people lived and worked within a narrow social circle and harbored a deep distrust of anyone outside it. "Never talk to strangers," the famous line from The Master and Margarita, was an article of faith in the Soviet Union. Sobchak lived what he admitted was the rarefied life of the intelligentsia, comfortable and increasingly circumscribed. And when campaigning outside his milieu, he discovered how little he knew of how ordinary people lived. Once elected, Sobchak made an impression when the Congress of People's Deputies convened in the spring of 1989. He joined a bloc of reformist legislators that included Andrei Sakharov, the dissident physicist, and Boris Yeltsin, the bearish party official who would become the first secretary in Moscow. And he passionately and eloquently hectored the Soviet leadership, the military, and the KGB in public hearings that were transmitted across the vast country. Sobchak chaired an investigation into the killing of 20 people during an anti-Soviet demonstration on April 9th in Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, exposing the mendacity of the official version of the military's crackdown there. The upheavals of 1989 had now spread to the Soviet Union itself, with unrest in Lithuania, Azerbaijan, and Armenia. Despite their last violent efforts to contain the fervor, the Soviet authorities no longer wielded enough power to hold the system together. A month after the Putins returned, Leningrad elected a new city council. Enough reformers and independents won to break the Communist Party's monopoly on municipal power. The new legislators were earnest, but also inexperienced, disorganized, and leaderless. A bloc of them appealed to Sobchak to run for one of 25 remaining vacant seats, and then, assuming he won, to compete for the job of council chairman. Sobchak's prominence in the Congress of People's Deputies in Moscow raised hopes that he would be a unifying leader for the city. He won his election and in May became the council's chairman, effectively the city's top elected official. Sobchak personified the transition to a new form of government, as one historian put it, where hope triumphed over reason. He was a legal scholar, not an administrator. And whatever his charisma, he had no experience governing a city of 5 million people, let alone at a time of political upheaval, with a recalcitrant bureaucracy still controlled by the communists. Sobchak needed allies and expertise, and he turned to the one institution where he thought he could find competent aides able to navigate what was becoming a treacherous political transition. He turned to the institution he had excoriated from the dais of the Congress of People's Deputies. He turned to the KGB. Shortly after taking up his new position, Sobchak telephoned Alek Kalugin, the former spymaster whose career fell afoul of KGB intrigue after his service in foreign intelligence, leaving him in internal exile in Leningrad. Kalugin had since joined the ranks of the Democratic Reformers and became one of the most prominent critics of his former agency. Now Sobchak had a favor to ask of him. Could he recommend someone inside the KGB whom he could trust as an advisor? He was suspicious of the bureaucracy. He needed a liaison to the security forces. Kalugin suggested a senior officer, a lieutenant general he trusted, but Sobchak dismissed the idea. Concerned that an outward alliance with the KGB might tarnish his democratic credentials, he wanted someone with a lower profile. A few days passed, and Sobchak called again. He asked Kalugin if he had ever heard of a young officer named Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin. Some would assume the KGB had a hand in directing the young officer into Sobchak's office, but according to Kalugin, it was Sobchak who recruited him. Vladimir Putin remembered Sobchak from his lectures in law school, but did not know him well. By his own account, a friend from law school had suggested he go see Sobchak, which he did with trepidation. He could hardly have agreed with some of Sobchak's most blistering criticisms of the KGB, and Sobchak's political future remained tenuous at best, like everything in the Soviet Union in 1990. Nevertheless, that May, he went to Sobchak's new office in the Mariinsky Palace, and Sobchak hired him on the spot. He said he would arrange his transfer with Merkuryev and told him to start the next Monday. First, though, Putin felt obliged to disclose his actual profession. "I must tell you that I am not just an assistant to the rector," he told Sobchak. "I am a regular officer of the KGB." In Putin's recollection, Sobchak hesitated and then, to Putin's surprise, dismissed this issue. "Fuck it," he replied. Putin insisted that he must inform his superiors and, if necessary, resign from the KGB. He agonized over the decision, his friend said. Although he had grown disillusioned, the KGB remained the institution he served loyally. In the event, whatever worries he had about the center's reaction were misplaced. The KGB was happy to have its own agent working undercover in the office of Leningrad's rising political star. This new democratic experiment, after all, was a dangerous thing that required eternal vigilance. And so, with the KGB's blessing, perhaps at its insistence, Lieutenant Colonel Putin remained in the service, continuing to earn his meager, if steady, salary, which was more than he earned as Sobchak's advisor. He was now living a double life, the life of the undercover agent at last, only inside his own country. He began to advise Sobchak even as he continued to work in a small office on the first floor of the university's red and white 12 Collegia building. His task there was to monitor foreign students and visitors who were arriving in increasing numbers as Glasnost eased travel restrictions. He no longer worked in the big house on Litieny Prospect, but he still paid occasional visits, the purposes of which could only have been to keep his superiors informed of the changing politics of the day, at the university and in Sobchak's office. When a delegation from St. Petersburg Community College in Florida arrived in the fall of 1990 for an educational exchange, it was the lieutenant colonel who played host to the college's unsuspecting president, Carl M. Cutler, Jr. Cutler had met Putin's university advisor, Valery Muzin, when he visited Florida and proposed establishing links between the two cities and the two universities. When Cutler and his delegation arrived, Putin met them at the airport and spent the next 10 days handling all the arrangements of their meetings, meals, and concerts and the symphony and ballet. He did so with a punctuality and efficiency that surprised Cutler, given the deteriorating economic conditions in the city, including a critical shortage of gasoline that produced long, frustrating lines. When Cutler went on an excursion out of the city, the government limousine was in danger of running out of fuel until Putin intervened and directed it to a city sanitation depot where it could find gas. His dual careers increasingly began to intersect. He introduced Cutler to Sobchak, and at a banquet on the last night, Sobchak had a favor to ask of Cutler. "Carl, would you do something for me?" he began. "We don't have much travel money." Sobchak had turned his sights to international travel and wanted to return again to the United States. Would you pay for it? Cutler raised the money, and Sobchak visited a month later. In Washington, he met President George H.W. Bush and senior congressional leaders. Procter & Gamble flew Sobchak's delegation to Cleveland for a day, and he stayed in Florida at Cutler's house on the bay, where he marveled at the environmental restrictions that forbade him to fell a single tree without permission from the municipal authorities. Putin credited the trip to America with Sobchak's decision to promote him to his permanent staff in 1991. He also remembered Cutler's behavior at the banquet. When it came time to reciprocate a toast, Cutler asked the surprised guests to hold hands, and he said a prayer. "You prayed for our university," Putin reminded him when they met again a decade later. "You prayed for our city. You prayed for our country. And you prayed for me." Cutler suspected the young university assistant had never before heard a prayer on his behalf. He never imagined that his host was a KGB officer. Lieutenant Colonel Putin's future was now increasingly affixed to a man apt to quote classical poets and artfully articulate what were once heresies. "We are all infected to some degree by the system," Sobchak wrote only a year after his new advisor came to work for him, musing on Pushkin's Bronze Horseman and what he called the system syndrome. "From birth, we have been taught intolerance, suspicion, and paranoid fear of spies." Sobchak envisioned a new Soviet Union that offered justice and hope, a democracy, a normal, civilized state in which there is no need to slaughter half the population to make the other half happy. The two men made an odd couple. They differed in age, in temperament, and in philosophy. Sobchak was flamboyant, charismatic. Putin reserved, inherently suspicious and secretive. He did not share Sobchak's hostility toward the Soviet Union, but he nonetheless served his new boss as loyally as he had his KGB commanders, and over time he began to absorb some of his superiors' views. Even as other KGB officers resigned on principle or in pursuit of new ways of making money, Putin hedged his bets. He never broke with the agency the way Kalugin had. He did not regret his service and never would. One of his superiors in Leningrad, who had also served in East Germany, Yuri Leshov, said service in the KGB was to Putin a sacred business. And yet Sobchak drew him deeper and deeper into the new politics of the era. He worked for the old regime and for those who would overthrow it. Leningrad's city council, while democratic, proved inept. Its members quarreled endlessly among themselves and with Sobchak over the powers of the chairman, but did little to address the city's dire needs for housing, food, and transportation. By the summer of 1990, the Soviet economy was lurching on the brink of collapse, and Leningrad and other cities began to run out of basic foodstuffs. The shelves of its meager stores emptied first of tea and soap, then sugar, cigarettes, and even vodka. Shortly after returning from the United States, where he had visited a well-stocked Kmart in Alexandria, Virginia, Sobchak forced the council to introduce ration cards. It was hardly famine, not with a black market flourishing, but rationing brought back horrifying memories of the siege. "Democracy is facing a hungry winter," Sobchak said, in defense of the plan. "It is crucial for democracy to survive this winter." By then, the KGB and Soviet military leaders had already begun to make emergency plans for the imposition of martial law. In January 1991, Gorbachev ordered the military to restore communist rule in Lithuania after days of protests, reversing the Republic's declaration of independence the year before. The assault culminated with a tank attack on the television tower in the capital, Vilnius. 14 people died, but Lithuanian leaders continued to defy Moscow and pressed ahead with a referendum on independence in February, which Gorbachev declared illegal. In June, Russia held its own presidential election, and Boris Yeltsin became a legitimately elected counterweight to Gorbachev's increasingly erratic and unpopular rule. The same month, Sobchak took advantage of the national election to win election to a newly created executive branch that would wield authority over the unwieldy city legislature. Only a month before, he had forced the council to create the position of mayor, which only he was in a position to win. The council's members were increasingly at odds with Sobchak's role as their chairman, and they hoped that by creating separate branches of government, they would be able to constrain his powers as the city's leader. Leningrad also held a non-binding referendum to restore the city's pre-revolutionary name, St. Petersburg. Sobchak had initially opposed the change, but he campaigned for the restoration of the city's name with savvy and tact. He described the change as the natural evolution of Peter the Great's vision of the city as a window to Europe, and he offered to remove Lenin's waxy corpse from its Red Square mausoleum and bury him with his relatives in Leningrad, in keeping with the revolutionary's last will and testament. His offer respected those who still revered Lenin and appeased those who wanted to end the cult that still surrounded him. When the election came, Sobchak won 66% of the vote, while a narrower majority, 54%, voted to change the city's name. Vladimir Putin played no role in the politics of the collapse of the Soviet Union. He merited no appearance in the many contemporaneous memoirs and histories of the monumental events of 1991, not even Sobchak's, which he wrote in the year after Putin began working for him. He remained a young functionary, accustomed to working in the ranks and in the shadows. His loyalties and his fate, though, now rested with the city's undisputed political leader, a man often mentioned as a future president of all Russia. After Sobchak's election, Putin ended his work at the university, and in June 1991, he joined the mayor's staff as the director of the city's new Committee on Foreign Relations. He made himself indispensable, a quiet, level-headed but stern presence, working in a sparsely furnished office. He worked so tirelessly and with such efficiency and brute determination, as one colleague put it, that he earned the unflattering nickname Stasi, only in part because of his tour of duty in East Germany. The KGB had not forgotten its officer in Sobchak's ranks. Coincidentally or not, Putin's colleagues showed up in his office one evening after Sobchak had rushed off on a trip and left his aide with three sheets of blank paper, each signed, to complete with assorted mayoral business. The officers who had come to him wanted one of them for some nefarious purpose he either did not know or never told. "Can't you see that this man trusts me?" Putin later claimed to have replied, showing them a folder with the papers in them. Putin did not refuse outright, but they did not insist either. They simply apologized and left. On August 17, 1991, the Putins went on vacation, driving to Kaliningrad to stay in a resort on the Curonian Spit, a narrow crescent of beaches, dunes, and forests on the Baltic Sea. Sobchak had spent that weekend in Lithuania to discuss his vision of a free trade agreement and then flown back to Moscow on the night of August 18th to take part 2 days later in the signing of a new Union Treaty that would effectively dissolve the Central Soviet state. Mikhail Gorbachev, Boris Yeltsin, and the party leader in Kazakhstan, Nursultan Nazarbayev, had secretly negotiated the agreement to transfer functions of the central government to the individual Soviet republics, significantly weakening the central authority of the Kremlin. The ceremony never took place. That night, inside the Kremlin, a group of hardliners had already set in motion a putsch, placing Gorbachev under house arrest at his vacation home in the Crimea and establishing the State Committee of the State of Emergency. The coup's leaders included Gorbachev's vice president, Gennady Yanayev, the prime minister, the ministers of defense and interior, and Vladimir Kruchkov, the former chief of foreign intelligence and now the chairman of the KGB. Their formal orders to the military and the KGB to take control were issued at 4 o'clock the morning of August 19th. The Putins heard the news the way most of the country did, first through a series of radio announcements, and then in special bulletins on state television that interrupted the broadcast of Swan Lake. Sobchak woke in his hotel room in Moscow when a friend telephoned from Kazakhstan to tell him the news. Tanks and paratroopers in armored vehicles had already poured into the streets of Moscow. Sobchak, with guards and a driver, went to Yeltsin's dacha, joining the leadership of the newly elected Russian parliament to organize the resistance. Sobchak's name, like Yeltsin's, was on the KGB's list of arrest warrants, but the arrests never began. Yeltsin urged Sobchak to return to Leningrad and lead the opposition to the putsch from there. Sobchak, along with a lone guard, made it to Sheremetyevo Airport and booked the next regularly scheduled flight to Leningrad. The putsch plotters, despite the declared state of emergency, allowed life to go on more or less normally, including routine air travel. The three KGB officers who met him in the airport lounge had orders to arrest him, but they simply disobeyed and waited with him until he boarded. "So now I had four guards, three with machine guns," Sobchak recalled. The putsch that the reformers had long dreaded could happen was turning into a farce. In Leningrad, the city's military commander, Colonel General Viktor Samsonov, had also received orders to deploy troops. He went on television at 10 in the morning to announce the state of emergency, outlawing any demonstrations and public gatherings, and dissolving all the political parties and social organizations that had sprouted like mushrooms in the previous 2 years. He also declared the formation of an emergency committee that would replace the city's newly elected government. The committee included local military and KGB leaders and the new Communist Party leader Boris Gidaspov. Sobchak's name was conspicuously absent, but not that of the rear admiral Sobchak had selected as his deputy chairman and later vice mayor, Vyacheslav Shcherbakov. He, too, was at a seaside resort on the Black Sea, and after flying back to Leningrad, disavowed any involvement in the putsch. By the time Sobchak's flight from Moscow landed at 2 o'clock, however, no troops had entered the city. General Samsonov's order had not been carried out. The city's police commander, Arkady Kramarev, sent a car that took Sobchak straight to the military headquarters on Palace Square, opposite the Hermitage, where the Leningrad Emergency Committee had convened. Kramarev was there already, openly resisting Samsonov's orders to clear the streets of the protesters who had begun to gather outside the city council's headquarters at the Mariinsky Palace. Sobchak burst in and blusteringly accused them of an illegal conspiracy that would result in a Nuremberg of their own. Sobchak ignored Gidaspov, the party boss who was to replace him as the city's leader, and focused his fury instead on General Samsonov. He cited specific instances of military commanders being used by corrupt or criminal party leaders, including the killings in Georgia he had investigated. Ever the lawyer, he challenged the legality of the general's orders on the technicality that they did not explicitly authorize a state of emergency in Leningrad. Kramarev later said that Sobchak berated the general in a tone he had almost certainly never heard in his years as an officer. "If you take a fateful step now, everybody will remember you as a traitor, an executioner," Sobchak told him. Whether because of Sobchak's anger or his logic, the general promised to reconsider the deployment of troops and dithered for crucial hours. Sobchak then sped to the city's television station and spoke live on the air that evening, appearing with Shcherbakov and the provincial legislative leader, Yuri Yarov. Both of them had been announced as local leaders of the emergency committee, but now it became clear to the public that they had not supported the putsch. The national television channels in Moscow had been seized, but Leningrad's channels had not, and they still broadcast across much of the Soviet Union. The station manager let the broadcast proceed, since Shcherbakov was there, assuming he was now in charge. Millions heard Sobchak's remarks and could see that the putsch faced resistance. "Once again, there is an attempt to block our people's path to freedom, democracy, and true independence," Sobchak began. He urged the population to gather the next morning in Palace Square. He referred to the putsch's leaders as former ministers, and then simply as citizens, as defendants in court were called. Throughout that first crucial day, Vladimir Putin remained at the beach resort more than 500 miles away. He reached Sobchak by telephone the night of August 19th, but did not return immediately, though he presumably could have. Instead, he waited until the next day, when he caught a regularly scheduled flight from Kaliningrad. He was, by all accounts, deeply ambivalent. A year and a half before, he returned from the crumbling Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe dismayed by what he considered the abandonment of its comrade nations, the humiliating retreat of its troops and intelligence officers, and the triumph of NATO, the West, and capitalism. Now the Soviet Union itself was coming apart at the seams, its republics, including Russia, moving entropically toward independence. It meant the dismemberment of his country, and the putsch's leaders, he would later say, simply aimed to stop that. He considered theirs a noble purpose. The KGB chairman, Kruchkov, widely considered a pompous, conniving boor, was, in his mind, a very decent man. Although Kruchkov's intentions were clear, the KGB's loyalties were not. Many officers loyal to the new Russian government aided Boris Yeltsin and the putsch's opponents with intelligence and even a printing press. Some younger officers even drafted a statement denouncing the coup. Lieutenant Colonel Putin, now working for one of the country's leading Democrats, had to choose a side. Shortly after dawn on August 20th, Sobchak went to the sprawling Kirov factory, which produced tanks, tractors, and the turbines used in the Soviet Union's nuclear submarines and icebreakers. The factory, the city's largest, was legendary in Soviet mythology because of its part in the Great Patriotic War, remaining open throughout the siege despite being only miles from the front. Sobchak wanted to arrive before the morning shift to rally the factory's 30,000 workers. He spoke in front of a car with a loudspeaker, after which the factory's managers offered to allow workers to join the rally he had called for in Palace Square. The factory, the police, and most of the city's elected officials were now openly defying the putsch. Thousands of Kirov workers marched in columns up Stachek Prospect to the center of the city. They knew to what this might lead, a machinist among them said. They felt that they were people, human beings. They had stopped being afraid. The crowd that gathered that day was the largest seen in Leningrad in decades. More than 130,000 people thronged Palace Square and adjoining streets for blocks around. Outside the Hermitage Museum, a banner declared "No to the military putsch." In contrast to the tense atmosphere in Moscow, where protesters braced for movements by the armored units in the city, the rally was orderly and hopeful, supervised by the police officers and KGB agents who were supposed to have prevented it from happening. According to one newspaper report, Sobchak had even discussed plans for the rally with the local KGB boss, Kurkov, agreeing that it would be conducted calmly. Sobchak spoke briefly, followed by Dmitry Likachev, a revered linguist, preservationist, and historian who had survived the Gulag and exile, who told the crowd that the people can no longer be forced to their knees. That evening, Sobchak appeared at a special session of the city council in the Mariinsky Palace. The situation in Leningrad is fully under control of the bodies of lawful power, he declared. The putsch collapsed in Leningrad before it did anywhere else. Putin arrived from Kaliningrad that afternoon, but did not attend the rally in Palace Square. He joined Sobchak at the Mariinsky Palace and remained there. He had watched the new acting president of the Soviet Union, Gennady Yanayev, hold the news conference the night before. Watched as Yanayev repeated the emergency committee's lies about Gorbachev's health and vowed to put an end to the present time of troubles, alluding to the occupation, war, and famine that had followed the death of Boris Godunov at the turn of the 17th century. Having embarked on the path of profound reforms, and having gone a considerable way in this direction, the Soviet Union has now reached a point at which it finds itself faced with a deep crisis, the further development of which could both place in question the course of reforms itself, as well as lead to serious cataclysms in international life, Yanayev said. But as he did, his voice trembled and his hand shook. The journalists present began asking probing questions. They even laughed at his improbable answers. Putin said he knew then that the putsch was doomed. No matter how deep his loyalty to the KGB, he would not follow the orders of this emergency committee, even if he supported their underlying intention of preserving the Union. Their effort to reassert Soviet power meant the end of it. Up until that time, I didn't really understand the transformation that was going on in Russia, he recalled of his return from East Germany. All the ideals, all the goals that I had had when I went to work for the KGB collapsed. And yet, siding with Sobchak would amount to a violation of his oath of office. And so, after 16 years of service to the KGB, he wrote his resignation. It was, he claimed, his second resignation. He said he had sent a similar letter a year before, though in far less dire circumstances. In the political turmoil surrounding the city council and later the mayor's office, Putin had confronted innuendo about his intelligence background. Some people hoped for help from it, others threatened to expose it. Either way, they wanted something from Putin, and he was just sick and tired of that brazen blackmail. He wanted to protect Sobchak and his reputation, as he had warned him when he first became his advisor. It was the hardest decision of his life, he said, but he drafted and sent his resignation. And then nothing happened. He never heard any more about his letter, which disappeared in the bureaucracy, if it ever reached it. Nor did he make any effort to follow up, a discrepancy he never would explain fully. This time, in the middle of the confused putsch, he told Sobchak of his decision to quit, making it clear to his boss and mentor that he had sided with him. Despite the huge public protest against the putsch, the situation in Leningrad remained unsettled. Yeltsin, acting as president of Russia, issued a decree naming Shcherbakov the military commander of the Leningrad district, effectively replacing General Samsonov, who was in fact quietly heeding Sobchak's warnings and staying on the sidelines. Putin organized the defenses at the Mariinsky, passing out pistols to Sobchak's advisors, though he later claimed he had left his KGB revolver in his safe, as he had in Dresden. A few thousand protesters remained in the square outside, keeping a nervous vigil behind makeshift barricades that would have served little purpose against a determined military assault. He once again found himself inside a building surrounded by a tense mob demanding freedom, only this time he was on their side of the barricade. Rumors of imminent military action continued to swirl, including a report around 3 a.m. that elite special operation troops had been deployed from a secret location inside the city and would march on Sobchak's office. They can polish us off in 5 minutes, Shcherbakov told Sobchak. For their safety, Sobchak and Putin fled and spent the night in the Kirov factory. By dawn, on August 21st, though, the putsch had crumbled. Gorbachev had been freed from house arrest and was returning to Moscow. Boris Yeltsin, the public face of the resistance, would become the leader of the new Russian nation that emerged. Sobchak had led the resistance in Leningrad and became one of that nation's most prominent new democrats. Not at all by his design, Vladimir Putin landed on the winning side of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And yet he did not share the euphoria that many Russians felt. On the contrary, the experience was for him a difficult one. Lyudmila and his friends described the period as the most trying of his life. "In fact," he said, "it tore my life apart." Colonel Leshev, who had been a superior in the Leningrad KGB headquarters, said Putin's resignation was more pragmatic than idealistic. There were no prospects, and in general, it was not clear what would happen with the intelligence service. It was a calculated risk. Had the putsch succeeded, he could have faced arrest. At a minimum, he would certainly have been unemployed after having resigned. As it was, he waited until the momentum had swung against the putsch. Leonid Polakov, who studied law with him at Leningrad State University and later became a military prosecutor who exposed the terrible rituals of hazing in the Soviet military during the Glasnost era, was simply stunned when he learned that his friend had left the service. "Volodya surprised me greatly two times. The first time, when he joined the KGB, and the second, when he left it," he said.